Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us this morning. The humanitarian crisis continues in Syria, where a protracted war by President Bashar al-Assad's regime on opposition groups has resulted in thousands of deaths and millions of displaced Syrians who fled to neighboring countries. Meanwhile, al-Qaeda operatives were reportedly behind a massive prison break in Iraq and have been sending fighters into Syria as well. Art Sear is our regular foreign policy contributor. He's director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. And he tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke it's hard to predict the direction the Syria crisis will move next.
The Assad regime has proven to be remarkably durable as well as brutal, and that's no surprise. It is important to have a regional perspective. And from that perspective, the massive prison break in Iraq does open the door, since it was engineered by a wing of the very loosely organized al-Qaeda operation, loosely organized but lethal al-Qaeda operation. I think the role of Islamic extremists and fundamentalists in Syria will probably continue to grow as it has in Iraq.
At some point, and this is a question that always strikes me in situations like this, when does a government start to, or a leader, start to wonder about what's left to govern? I mean, at a certain point, with so many of its citizens gone and with so much instability, why would you even want to stay in power?
Well, the alternatives for Assad and immediate associates and family members is not all that promising. So, and I think nationalism and perhaps more positive motivations are there, but sheer survival. And also the regime, compared to some others in the tumultuous Middle East today, the regime has held up pretty well, actually. They may well endure short term, but the long term trend is undeniable. It's toward overthrowing these dictatorships and toward some form of, albeit tumultuous, representative government.
What do you make of the West's continued approach in Syria, and what more could countries such as the U.S. be doing or ought to be doing?
I don't think there's much that we can do. I believe one of President Obama's strengths is great caution and care concerning direct employment of military force overseas. The Assad regime is a bad regime, thoroughly evil from our moral point of view, and probably pretty corrupt. But just because we want to overthrow them doesn't mean that the alternative would be better. I think it's extremely important for us to keep in mind that our ability to influence events in foreign countries, especially in such a culturally distant part of the world, is limited.
So in short, you're saying that the negative consequences well outweigh the positive ones, even in terms of preventing a larger humanitarian crisis.
Yeah. In terms of direct intervention, we have proven that we can protect our interests. A couple of years ago, the Israelis very effectively took out by airstrikes an ominous nuclear facility that the Syrians were building with the help of North Koreans. I'm confident that, as usual, U.S. as well as Israeli intelligence was involved in planning the strikes. But it shows that when our basic national interests are concerned and alliance interests are concerned, we can't protect them, even in a dangerous and quite alien and ugly environment like Syria.
So let's move a little southwest to Egypt. You talked about tumultuous democracy. The military is still running the show after ousting President Morsi in a coup earlier this month. Morsi's family accuses the military of kidnapping him. His whereabouts are still kind of questionable.
Right.
Is there any hope for the future of democracy in Egypt, or have things permanently gone back to the way they were before those first democratic elections there?
No, I think what's going on in the Middle East is part of a widespread global change dating from the American and French revolutions. We've discussed this before. I don't want to get too academic or repetitious now, but I think pressure for representative government is over the long term unavoidable. Again, what's most important, I think, for Americans is to look to our national interests. And there are the Camp David Accords, the basic peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. As far as I know, they've held. Our Israeli friends have complained about Egyptian tank movements, which Netanyahu argues have been contrary to the agreement, but I'm not sure that's true. Our Israeli friends are usually complaining about something in terms of their security. As long as Camp David holds, I think that shows that we have an essentially responsible government in Egypt from the viewpoint of American interests. The Egyptian military, I'm not in favor of military dictatorships and takeovers, but the military is traditionally strong, essentially responsible, basically not corrupt, strongly reflecting their British training and heritage. I don't think it's completely negative that the army is currently in charge, albeit the kibosh been put on democracy temporarily.
Well, and there have been demonstrations both in support of and against Morsi in recent days.
Right.
And the anti-Morsi demonstrations have often taken an anti-American tack as well. What do you make about the implications for continued relations with the West?
I think given the economic importance of the West and the economic importance of long-established relationships and the fact that the Suez Canal remains, as it has been since it was built in the 1800s, a basic global trade artery, Egypt has to remain involved with the West. I think we Americans are a lot more sophisticated than we used to be, internationally speaking, and that's all to the good. We've always been good-hearted, but we like to see the world in terms of good guys and bad guys. I don't want to blame John Wayne, but I mean we have a culture that tends to oversimplify diplomatic complexities, and it's good for us to see that in the Midwest, in the Mideast, as in the Midwest, there's not just good guys and bad guys in competition.
That is our view from the Midwest, anyhow.
Right. Perhaps more than other parts of the country are quite right.
Let's move to China, if we can.
Sure.
There's reportedly been a crackdown on activists in China, not the first time, probably not the last time. But does that fly in the face of the Chinese government's recent claims of weeding out corruption among its own leaders?
No, I don't think the two are necessarily inconsistent. It remains an authoritarian regime. But they're under tremendous pressure, partly because of the pervasive importance of the internet and global media, as well as commerce. Both dimensions create tremendous pressure for transparency. And the Chinese, if they want to continue to make money, and they've got to make money if that regime is going to survive, they're in a difficult dance of trying to preserve control at the same time open up to a degree. I think much more serious is the likelihood that the Chinese economy will slip into something like recession from the fantastic growth they've enjoyed over the last couple of decades. Slowdown in construction of government buildings, I think, is in some ways the most significant indicator of change of all in China. But I do think something like dictatorship can coexist with more and more representative government on the mainland for a long time.
The rest of the world, and the U.S. in particular, slipped into its recession some time ago.
Right.
Does it just take that long for it to catch up to China?
Possibly. I'm not an in-depth expert on the detailed trends, but I think your point is very perceptive. The global financial collapse wasn't as serious as it might have been in 2007 through 2009 and into 2010. Partly because we are a globally integrated financial as well as trade system. And not just China, but Asia generally didn't fall into recession. They really helped keep the global engine moving. Just as when the Asian financial collapse occurred in 1997, it didn't translate into a global recession or even collapse then, because China, as well as to some extent Japan, were essentially impervious to that wider collapse. And because, to his credit, Bill Clinton and then Secretary of the Treasury Bob Rubin engaged in some very, very effective executive action to minimize the impact of the financial collapse in Asia.
And to perhaps somewhat happier news.
I hope so.
Let's talk briefly about the royal baby. Let me ask you this. Is there any significance to the arrival of the royal baby in England, aside from the headlines it gives to the tabloids for the next 40 or 50 years?
Well, it's not just the tabloids. It's the serious press. The Wall Street Journal this morning has a rather perceptive, in-depth guest editorial about the importance of the royal family. And it's not just the tabloid population, but even NPR. We're talking about it now that pays attention to this. Walter Bagehot, B-A-G-E-H-O-T, was the editor of The Economist for 17 years back in the 1800s. He wrote a book called The English Constitution, in which he developed at length the point that we have dignified and efficient functions in our country. Thankfully, they're separated. We have government, parliament, the prime minister, cabinet. The people don't attach much passion to them because we have the monarchy, which has very limited power, but which is a target of all the emotional dimensions of politics. One challenge for the Americans is that we don't have a monarchy, which is why at least since the Second World War, we have had this basically, I think, positive, not particularly harmful fixation on the royal family. But who is king or queen in the royal in Britain does have a global political impact because there's so much interest in the monarchy and because of their influence.
This is kind of the notion of the royal family as a global emotional safety valve.
That's well put, yes. I think you really summed up my long-winded answer. And it can be serious, all kidding aside.
You were just in England, and
yes.
this is a huge deal for the collective British psyche.
That's right. And it reflects, I think, why, because of this emotional attachment, it reflects why the monarchy has survived so long. It can be serious with very negative consequences, depending on who's on the throne. In the 30s, Edward VIII abdicated as King of Britain and was succeeded by George VI, who was rightly admired and celebrated in the successful film The King's Speech. Edward VIII, the public story was he had married an American divorcee of questionable background and blah, blah, blah. The real reason that there was a cross-party coalition, including the monarchist Winston Churchill, to get rid of him, was that he was pro-Nazi. He was a very strange, eccentric person. He liked to play dress-up. He loved his cowboy outfit from Tom Mix. But what he really liked was his Nazi regalia, which he'd gotten from those fine chaps in Berlin. You can imagine what the impact might have been, quite negatively, not just for the British Isles and Empire and Commonwealth, but for all of us if this character had stayed on the throne.
But all of that is behind us, and we can all start to obsess over what the latest royal heir will be wearing when he makes his first public appearance.
Yeah, well, one never knows what's going to happen in the world. 1913, people looked ahead to endless progress in the 20th century, referring to the past that isn't so distant. Speculation that's reasonable is that Queen Elizabeth has stayed on the throne so long. She's now in her 80s because she's very good at it. She's very responsible compared to some of her screwball relatives. Prince Charles, we're not making any direct comparisons with the monarch we were discussing, but he's very offbeat and unusual, that she's holding out maybe for William to take over at some point, which seems to make sense. And the more this positive traditional family image between him and Kate and the new baby can be reinforced, why the better. We can make fun of them, and the British make fun of them, but it is a serious institution with some influence, especially when there's a crisis.
Art Sear, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad we could talk about the British.
Art Sear is the Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business and the Director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He joins us periodically to talk about foreign policy. Coming up next, we'll talk with two Syrian artists, activists, and political refugees about their experience of the crisis in Syria and how they hope art will make a difference. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM.